Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very gladly ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, so I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I was really situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator's screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right. Lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you for your comments and your disclaimers. I appreciate that very much. Before we turn the call over to PJ tonight, I want to bring your attention to a 1901 Supreme Court decision. This is referred to as Downs versus Bidwell. It can be found at 182 U.S. 244. Herein, the Supreme Court Justice John Marshall Harlan predicted much of what we see occurring in our courts today. And I quote, "The idea prevails with some, indeed it has found expression in arguments at the bar, that we have in this country substantially two national governments, one to be maintained under the Constitution with all of the restrictions, the other to be maintained by the Congress outside and independently of that instrument, by exercising such powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to." I take leave to say that if the principles thus announced should ever receive the sanction of a majority of this court, a radical and mischievous change in our system of government will result. We will, in that event, pass from the era of constitutional liberty, guarded and protected by a written constitution, into an era of legislative absolutism. It will be an evil day for American liberty if the theory of government outside the supreme law of the land finds lodgment in our constitutional jurisprudence. No higher duty rests upon this court than to exert its full authority to prevent all violations of the principles of the Constitution. End quote. So, with that little bit of wisdom there, let's turn the call over to PJ and have him share with us tonight exactly how his methods and the methods of his associates can change the paradigm within a courtroom today. PJ?
Okay. One of the things we deal with quite a bit is the California Franchise Tax Board. They are probably the most aggressive people to collect federal taxes of all the states. And we've realized that there's about four categories to work with them. And one group is they paid taxes for 20 years and then they're no longer doing it. And all the way to the far other spectrum is they're still paying taxes and they're sending letters to ask the California Franchise Tax Board if they're required, eligible, liable to do anything with them, pay or file or anything like that. And what we found is that over the years, the easiest group to win in is the one where the people have their so-called taxes paid up to date. So what we're experiencing is that it's not always to start the battle by stop paying the way you have been. The reason it becomes more difficult and they dig in their heels, in a sense, is when you stop paying, it goes into a judicial environment, goes into a court environment. And, of course, the court, no judge, no status judge wants to be the individual that brought down the state's ability to collect the majority of its taxes from individuals, men and women in California. Of course, they can collect taxes from their corporations, especially when the corporations have income generated in a federal zone. Still debatable if they can actually collect income derived by the activities of a corporation if the business that corporation was doing is outside of the federal zone. Now, it's very likely the federal zone is domiciled perpetually in the District of Columbia or one of the federal states. So no matter where they make their money abroad, the corporations are still taxable. That's probably the case, just like it is for an individual that actually is paying federal taxes as a matter of law. They're domiciled in District of Columbia, like a U.S. citizen. I guess what I'm trying to communicate to the listeners tonight is that no matter what tax issue you have, it's better off to continue what we're learning, which is contrary to what I've been doing in the past, because most people just get fed up and quit paying and then tell them to bring it on. But anyway, continue to pay, and then we start the process of notifying the government to inform you if you're required to file or pay. For some reason, well, we know the reason, because when you do it that way, it does not, the courts are not one of the sources of remedy. You're actually doing it, you're exhausting your remedies before anybody goes to court. And they realize that they don't have a leg to stand on, so they don't have any reason not to answer your question properly. One individual not one individual, but a group of individuals that I work with, I can't remember the percentage, but it's still an uphill battle. But 20 to 30% of the issue is resolved simply with letters within a six-month period with the California Franchise Tax Board. California Franchise Tax Board is basically the state tax. And I think I got that right. They might get involved with the property taxes too. But and the property taxes are the same way. Best thing to do is continue to pay your taxes and then contact us, and we'll assemble the letters to request one of their agents to attest to an amount due and owing. A lot of their forms for their taxes, you have to qualify. Even a marriage license, you have to qualify to fill out a state marriage license. And one of the qualifications is that you're a state person. And in order for you to be a state person, you either have to be a United States citizen, which is perpetually domiciled in a federal zone, or a individual that resides in a in a state land. For example, Nebraska is 1.5% state land. So if you reside in those that 1.5%, you're eligible because of your resident fee to go to the state of Nebraska and get a marriage license. If you do not reside in that 1.5% land area, then you do not qualify for the marriage license. And I've never seen anyone ever benefit by qualifying for a marriage license. The only time you benefit from a marriage license is if you have a completely dysfunctional marriage and you need the state for protection, I guess. I can't see any other reasons that would be a value for it. Because you can do the same marriage dividing of the assets and dealing with the kids under common law. You don't have to go under statutory courts. But you basically go into the same courtroom, but you use common law instead of written laws that apply to United States citizens and legal fictions such as corporations created under the laws of the state or the United States. So, is there any, Michael? Let's go ahead and start the questions right away. And if anybody wants to ask a question along the way, they'll know how. Could you go ahead and throw that out there?
Well, sure. You press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. You press star 2 on your keypad. For those of you listening on Freedoms Radio, you'll simply see to the center of your monitor the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or question. On the outside of that rectangle, you'll see a place to put your contact information, then hit submit, and then I will be happy to give voice to your comment or question, and PJ will be happy to answer. So that's how you do it. Let me refresh to see if anybody has already raised their hands. I don't see that. Go ahead. All right, go ahead, PJ.
Okay. Now, as far as let's just take a look at federal taxes. The same scenario is there. We have a program. We have perfected documents. Everybody has their own opportunity to contact the federal or the state government or the a property tax issue or anything. What we give you is just an example of what we've done in the past, and then you can create your own and send it out on your own, because they get a lot more traction than something that looks like it's boiler room produced. For some reason, they don't like boiler room produced documents, and they come after the people that produce them and look for a weakness in their armor and attack them. So we avoid that because we just become a provider of information, and then you take that information and you tweak it to match your needs and basically ask the individual that's making a claim against you as for any performance that they are claiming that you're required to do. Pay a parking ticket, pay federal taxes, pay state taxes, pay property taxes, pay any tax. One of the principles of taxes is a simple way to look at tax is if you're doing an activity, they have to prove that you do not have a right to that activity. It might be going down a specific road with a specific device. It might be a bicycle. It might be walking. It might be an airplane. It might be a car, motorcycle, bicycle, whatever. If they're going to stand in the road, basically, and require something from you, they have to produce evidence that you have no right to pass in that land, through that land, as a right. Now, if you don't have right to pass, then the only thing left is privilege and permission. And with privilege and permission, they can ask for a specific payment or performance or some activity from you, fill out a form, whatever. But if it is a right, they have no constitutional authority to, they have no, there's no place in the Constitution where they can ever tax a right. They can't tax a right at all. If they can tax an activity, it is not a right. And if they are taxing a right, it's unconstitutional. It's just that simple. So if you have a wish to possess a specific gun, pistol, rifle, shotgun, machine gun, whatever it takes, there's a reasons why people buy machine guns and use them in military actions, because they found that it's 60 times more effective than a single action lever gun. It really puts out a lot of defense the moment you need it. You may have a right, God-given right, to defend yourself with whatever device is required at that moment and location. Obviously, if you're in the middle of a football field with 100,000 people around, you don't want to be spraying the area with a machine gun. That would be a violation of man and God's laws. But you certainly might be able to have a firearm in there to defend yourself against one attacker that you can signal out and deter his attack on you. So every situation is different. But sometimes you'll see something on YouTube where a police officer is or a group of police officers is trying to stop a bank robbery or something, and the bank robber's got machine guns, and the cop's got these little stub-nosed pistols. It doesn't go very well for the cops. And I guarantee you that they wish they had a machine gun or a much better device than that pistol. A lot of times they do have a better device in their trunk, but it takes them a while to get to that. Or the SWAT team, they'll come in with their rapid fire equipment, but it's going to take you 20 to 30 to 45 minutes for the SWAT team to get there. But anyway, it's interesting. The reason I bring that up is we've had situations where we've been in court and we just simply asked the judge and the moving party, where in the Constitution am I forbidden to have a gun? That particular device in my possession on a particular day at a particular location. Show me. We're in the Constitution. If the Constitution doesn't forbid me, then it remains a right, because they are bound by the Constitution. A lot of times the judges will say it's policy. Okay, well, all their policy has to be constitutional. And another one will say, well, it's public safety. Well, all their public safety has to be constitutional. So it still goes back to the Constitution. One of the things we've got going on now is COVID. If you've noticed in Australia, they shut the entire nation down. And they've only had, I think, 1,200 deaths from COVID. And the chances are possibly none of the deaths are from COVID. It's really from the poor treatment that they give, or the people that got this serious flu, which they call COVID, were in bad health situation anyway. And if they would have caught a average cold, they would have passed away. But anyway, they are using that excuse to completely turn the Australia into a state lockdown nation. And in America, the Constitution forbids them from doing that. So that Constitution is very powerful. But a lot of people have spent almost no time being taught by a person that has a good understanding of the proper use of the Constitution. Michael and I both are learning leaps and bounds in the last 6 months from individuals that we're meeting. Would you agree with that, Michael, in relationship to the importance of quoting the Bill of Rights in the courtroom?
Most certainly.
Yeah, I knew they were there, but I just didn't know they were just quite that powerful. The judge can do almost everything in a courtroom except violate your rights. So that's what you really got to focus on is your rights. Did they have a right to pull you over? Did they have a right to fine you? Did they have a right to regulate your speed? Did they have a right, whatever, write you a parking ticket at a specific location?
Okay.
Go ahead, Michael.
Brian has raised his hand here. Let's see what he's got to ask. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, let's do.
Hi, Michael. Hi, PJ. Thank you for everything. Regarding property taxes, does the particular individual need to, supposedly own the property through the bank before they can engage your services regarding property tax? Or could they have a loan at a bank and be paying property tax and still utilize your services?
Yeah, a loan is a loan. It's just mortgaged by an asset may be mortgaged, put up as like a surety. But the land is yours. The bank doesn't own it. The bank may get control of the land if they can prove that they have an agreement, written agreement, that if you don't have specific performance, that they become have a right to own the land or sell the land and get paid. But that would be a contract that doesn't change ownership. Now you don't own it completely. If somebody can take it away from you, you don't own it completely, such as property taxes. If they can take it away from you for property taxes, you do not own it completely. Now, it's possible that in some situations the property taxes are laid against the property under contract instead of as a matter of law. If the government owns land, they are taxing it as a matter of law. If the government doesn't own it, it's possible they're taxing it under probably a pretense of ownership or taxability as a matter of law, but it's really finagled into a contract if it ever goes to court. And of course, the U.S. judges, the U.S. courts are they're not going to tell you it's a contract, but they're going to enforce the collection of the tax if you don't argue it, challenge it properly. But anyway, the bottom line is either you own it or you don't. Either the United States owns it or they don't. And they have to, if they have a claim to ownership, if anybody has a claim to ownership, they have to produce that evidence. And what evidence do you have for claim of ownership? You have a deed, warranty deed, deed of conveyance? That's a question to you.
Right. Very, very interesting. I've got friends, that bought into houses, and now the prices are going up, and they're getting run out of them because of the property tax alone. No, very interesting. That answers my question. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Well, what evidence do you have that you own your home?
Well, I was a landlord and I just recently sold mine. So all I had was, I can't remember what I had, but what is the basic evidence?
Normally it's a warranty deed.
Okay.
Okay. So you had a deed. A deed is just simply an activity, that happened one time in history. The deed shows that you sat down at a table with somebody and you handed them $100,000 and they handed you the rights to the property. You did a deed and they did a deed. That's all it is. But anyway, if the state comes in and wants to claim a right to property tax payment, they have to produce that evidence. And as I introduce this meeting tonight, this talk show tonight topic, we found that it's best you continue to pay the taxes and then contact us and then we challenge the taxes. And we can do it non-judicially much easier than we can judicially, because the judges will just rule against us normally to protect the state agenda. Whereas if we do it a different remedy other than going to court, then it forces them to they actually will give us a document that you're no longer required to pay taxes, property taxes on a specific piece of land.
Does the same principle apply to income taxes, where you should keep on paying until you engage
Generally, yes. But you can start on that a whole year early, you know.
Right.
January 1st, you know, right now. Start on it right now. And you got till...
Even if someone is pending an audit?
Even if somebody's what?
Pending an audit from the IRS.
Why would they be auditing you? Because you stopped payment is why they're auditing you, or what?
Yeah. Well, no, because of potential things that would be applicable to them versus where I would disagree.
Oh. Well, the audit doesn't affect your right to them to produce. See, you're the boss. Their employment is because of you. If you didn't exist, the employer, they wouldn't have a job. So you're the boss here, and they have to, as a matter of law, statutory law and common law, the employer must answer to the boss. And that's the position you go in there. They can't say, we don't have to answer you, and you know, we have evidence that they're employed by you. So, answer the question. They have trouble. They don't like to be told that.
I think PJ, that's the most difficult mentality most have to overcome. Is you know that transition in court where you know you are the boss, and whereas you know you feel like a minion when you're in there. So.
Yeah, that doesn't mean you can boss them around. But
right.
Because the their employment guidelines are written, it's predominantly in the Constitution. So you know, where in the Constitution am I required to pay property taxes? Starts right there. And they'll say something like, "Well, all property in the state is taxable." Okay, what evidence do you have that my land is in this state? Because right here, it gives a definition of in this state for, let's just say you live in Texas. We can find the statute that says what in this state means. And then you show it to them. Okay, this is what in this state. It's the term. This is what it's defined as, possession or territory of the United States. Okay, what evidence do you have that that land is a possession or territory of the United States? And they go, well, I've never seen that before. What is that? That's the state that you're talking about. I suggest you talk to your attorney and answer that question. And this is why you want to have this outside of court, because the judge will oftentimes not make them answer that. But if you give them, you put the pressure on them well before you ever get to court, then they look really, really bad for not answering that 2 years ago like they should have.
A couple of things that PJ shared with me a while back is the definition, quote, in this state or within the state. It's actually defined and says in this state or within the state means within the exterior limits of the state of state and includes all the territory within these limits owned by or ceded to the United States of America. So you take that, and then you go to the United States Code, Title 1, Chapter 1, and Section 2. The word county includes, and the word includes means it's limited to and specific to, a parish or any other equivalent subdivision of a state or territory of the United States. So when you have property tax, it's because the assertion is by the United States government that is a subdivision where you live of the United States versus one of the states within the freely associated compact states. Back to you.
Yeah, very good. Very good. And it's interesting when you lay this out. They have it written they must have it written to properly identify the land that is taxable. But they do it in such a way that it's hid from the common person. It takes a computer to find these things. You can't just go in there. If you want to spend a whole week reading some of their laws and stuff, or legislative laws, you'll stumble across it. But the computer has made it so much easier to find them. It's even hard to find them with a computer if you don't know what you're doing. But in this state, is one term. Within the state is another term. State, just state alone, is another term. Those three are three of the terms that I found that different jurisdictions use to define that land that is taxable within the exterior borders of a specific area of land. So they have to prove it. Now this premise overshadows all this is that if you have a right to own that land, how do they have a authority to tax it? They can't tax a right. They can't govern a right. They can't limit a right. They can't even have a legislative meeting to talk about it. Man's rights. They're forbidden from doing that. So how, if that's not a right, then it's taxable. If it is a right, then it's being taxed. That means the tax is being unconstitutionally applied. Doesn't mean the law is unconstitutional. The written law is constitutional, but it's being unconstitutionally applied. All their laws can be unconstitutionally applied to the wrong land or the wrong person. All of them can be, and most of them are in grand scale. Most Americans do not have to file a 1040 tax form, but the 1040 tax form is completely constitutional. It's unconstitutionally applied in a big, big way. Go ahead. Next question.
Anything else, Brian?
No, sir. That was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Anyone else? Press star 2 on your keypad. Press star 2, please, on your keypad. Hello, Nancy. Go ahead. Yeah. Just talking about you today.
Uh-oh. This is all
you had contacted us back in I think it was August or October.
Yeah, right. About the truck.
And so we were going through the old whatever happened to this, what happened to that, to that. Anyways, go ahead. What's your
nothing
question?
Nothing happened because I just didn't have the funds to do that. But it's okay. Still, you know, it's still on the table. It still needs to be done. And I was thinking about it today. But anyhow, here's my question. I have a local court here in this municipal court on a number of occasions for traffic violations. I lost all the cases. I have thousands of dollars of warrants for, you know, non-payment of the fines, or actually one was for contempt. I don't think there's anything that can be done about it at this point because I went about it, well, first of all, they're just old, and I've already gone through the mill on it. But at one of the hearings, I brought up in my defense the Constitution, and the magistrate told me that the Constitution does not apply in this court. So what do you say about that?
Wrong court.
Well, it may not.
That was the perfect segue. That was the perfect segue to challenge land jurisdiction and personam jurisdiction. My God. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, this was 5 years ago. I was, you know, just getting to learning all this. At that point, you know, I was attempting to claim jurisdiction at the very arraignment thing. But anyway, I just got sandbagged and denied and pushed along. But it came to that point where I did bring up the Constitution, and that's what he said. Well, the Constitution does not apply in this court. So here's what I thought he meant, that this, his court is a, you know, the federal, you know, government court. So they only go by statutes and codes. So how would the Constitution apply there?
That's not true, though. The
okay.
courts, the American courts, have authority to enforce the written laws of the United States. Okay,
mm-hmm.
is the Constitution is going to be part of the written laws of the United States? Correct. Obviously, yes. Now the only other thing they have authority to enforce is common law. And contract is common law. So generally people don't, the legal profession, they don't like to use the word common law, but they do like to use contract law. So the U.S. courts,
uh-huh.
if you take a piece of paper and draw a line down the middle and you're going to have a topic, generally, if you know, on one side, on the right side, it's going to be common law, on the left side, it's going to be United States written law. Generally, the issue is going to land on one or the other side. It's very seldom does it land on both sides. But they have to tell you which side it landed on, and then you can challenge. You know, if it lands on the written law side, how did that written law begin to act against you? Did you go into a federal zone? Is there a land ownership issue here that you're not aware of at the location where the activity occurred?
Mm-hmm.
And then if it lands on the contract side, you know, where's the evidence that you entered into a contract? Because a contract has to be full disclosure, meeting of the minds, and it cannot be a juries generally do not enforce unconscionable contracts. You know, like prostitution, they'll say, oh, that's a contract. Well, God says otherwise. you might call it a contract. I might call it a contract as a perverse person. But God says, it's not a contract. It's a violation of his laws. So, anyway, that's the way you go at it. You get them to, if they say it's not a constitutional issue, then where's the terms of the contract?
Okay, well, that's all long and over with, but I just thought, had always thought of that, you know, ever since. Well, what was he talking about? How could he say that? Anyway, that blew my defense out of the water.
Just because he said that doesn't mean it's true. You know, when the judge says something, he's supposed to, you can ask him for findings of facts and conclusions of law to support his statement. He says it's not a constitution doesn't apply here. Well, I need findings of facts and conclusions of law on that.
Right.
He might write a document up and say, well, the driver's license is a contract. Okay.
Yeah,
so
I don't have one.
Let's focus on the driver's license. Yeah, okay, you didn't have one. That's good. But let's just say you had one in your pocket that day and you handed it to the officer, or when the officer arrested it, he took it out of your purse and kept it and put it in part of the record. You have to be a resident of the state to have a motor vehicles operation driver's license. Some states call it an operation motor vehicle operations license or something like that. But they have to. If you have one of those, then there's no evidence that you have ever. Were actually, as a matter of law, a resident of the state, like residing in their land that they own. You don't have a driver's license. You don't have a marriage license. You don't have a state fishing license. You don't have any other license, because you can't have their license, because they all require a residency. So, it's very interesting when, some of these professional people that I work with, they go into court and they ask proof of residency, and they put in a specific affidavit of negative averments and so forth, and man, they don't know what to do. They go, oh my gosh, we never thought about this before. I had one judge, he was just dumbfounded that when I told him, I says, I've never been qualified or been eligible or required to have a state driver's license. And he says, well, our records show you have one. He says, there's no evidence that I qualify or eligible or required to have a driver's license. So that case just disappeared. So
okay.
If they ever try to collect on those patents, if they ever try to collect on those past bills, contact Michael, and we have a process to force them to stick with the Constitution on collection of monies due that they.
No, they're not trying to collect. They're not. There's warrants out. Those aren't really warrants. They're really capiuses. Basically, they don't come looking for you. You know, if you get stopped again and then the officer looks it up and sees there's warrants, then yeah, I'll probably get arrested then. But they've been sitting there for many years now. The first batch was 5 years ago. The second batch was, I don't know, 3 years ago or more. Yeah, I just haven't been able to figure out how to get them off the books, and I don't really like them there, and I haven't figured out how to safely, you know, be able to travel, so I don't really go anywhere, a little bit around town, and that's it, because
well,
I don't want to
risk. You can sue them for damages. They're, if you have a right to travel and they've got something hanging out there that's preventing you from doing that, every jury will understand that. You can challenge it in court.
Hmm.
But anyway, right. Okay. Next question.
Thank you, Nancy. Next question comes from, and the last question is for Tommy. Go ahead, Tommy.
All right. I was just wondering if a police officer says you are a resident because you are living on private property that is currently being taxed. Is he lying about that, or does he really don't know?
He doesn't know. Most judges don't even know. So,
okay.
Now, I think every federal judge in the nation knows. But no, that's not even true, because we've sat down with federal judges. They didn't know it either. So, I'd say a third of the judges that are at the highest levels know it. You know, the highest district court levels and the federal court levels, they know it. But they know that most people don't know it. For an example, a friend of mine went into a city office, and they were trying to apply a municipal code to his private property, and he just kind of whispered to the lady there, and he says, "Do you know that the municipal codes don't apply to private property?" And she leaned forward, and she says, "Yeah, but they don't know that." So she knew it. In the same way, these people that on property tax. I'm in court quite often on property taxes, and those attorneys, they hate to talk to me. They just hate to talk to me because I ask them, "Well, what do you rely upon if that property is taxable?" "Well, you paid taxes on it before in the past." I said, "What is that? All you is that all you have?" And they just hang up the phone. They won't talk to me anymore. Because it doesn't make if I paid taxes on it. Because if I'm not qualified or required or eligible to pay property taxes on property, it can only rise to the level, or federal taxes or state taxes. It can only rise to the level of a donation. And if my intent wasn't a donation, then it was coercion. So I could go into court and go for damages. Anyway, lots of ways to look at it. But if it's a right, it can't be taxed. And if they're taxing a right, they're doing it unconstitutionally. It's just that simple.
Okay. Right. Also, on a Terry stop, what is the legal amount of time they can hold you? Is it 30 minutes or is it 45?
I don't know. I just don't know.
Does it vary state to state?
If they're not on state land, they don't have any authority to hold you at all. Except under common law, and common law requires that they must have articulable evidence that you're committing a felony. A crime. So if they do have authority, then they're doing it within their land jurisdiction, and they have a lot of authority to do stuff there. But most of what they do, they don't have land jurisdiction. But it's very difficult to win on land jurisdiction because the judges they cover each other. They cover.
I just did a search and said the Court of Appeals decision effectively established a per se rule that a 20-minute detention is too long to be justified under the Terry Doctrine. 20 minutes is too long, they said.
20 minutes.
Yeah. And I've been stopped by cops. It took them 45 minutes to find everything they wanted against me. So it gets kind of crazy at times.
Yeah, and for people who don't know what a Terry stop is, that's just when a cop pulls you over or pulls up behind you for some reason. If you're somebody called in a suspicious vehicle.
Yeah. But anyway, as soon as they walk up and talk to you and they find out that you're not doing anything wrong, they're supposed to let you go, and they can get that information in 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank everybody for joining us. We had a good attendance tonight. We'd like to see break loose and have some new people ask some fresh questions. Be back next week again. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.